Welcome to our panel on climate change and public health. I think we should start, even though there may be still a few people trailing in, because we really only have an hour until 3:15, and then there's an SEJ meeting that everyone is invited to at 3:30, and there are refreshments. So, give it another minute. All right, so my name is Francesca Lyman, and I've written about global warming over many years, and the public health aspect of it is something that I've, you know, devoted a lot of attention to, and I think it's one area that reporters and writers have given a bit of short shrift to, and I've noticed more attention to it in the last year. Because of last year's drought and heat waves, the issue of climate change really came to the fore as never before. It also brought to the fore in a really dramatic way the connection between climate change and a range of new emerging diseases. There were outbreaks of West Nile virus, hantavirus, and dengue fever. In Dallas last August, there was a plane spraying for West Nile virus, using insecticide to kill mosquitoes to limit the spread of the virus. And in California, in the Yosemite National Park, there was a camper who died of hantavirus in one of the cabins, and there have been dengue fever outbreaks. And in Europe, I just noticed there were all sorts of really exotic tropical diseases like Usutu virus, Chikungunya virus, and, you know, all of these things are rather, it's sort of this bloom of tropical exotic diseases happening, and one wonders what the public health community is doing about it. In fact, they are really on this. The CDC is working with 19 states across the United States. And so there's actually a large effort going forward. So the panel of experts that I have here, I am so delighted to have and to introduce to you, who can tell us more about this and why reporters need to be focusing attention on it. So let me start with Kim Knowlton, who is a senior scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council, who is devoted exclusively to climate change and health. And you can tell us a little bit more about what you're doing. Thanks. All
right. Can people hear me? Wait, can people hear me now? Because I see some heads nodding in the back. Okay, it is great to be here. It's fantastic that there's a whole panel on climate change and health, because I'm a health scientist. I work, as Francesca said, solely on climate change. And I am about this. Climate change is a matter of health. It's my job to go out there and try and connect the dots between climate change. You've heard from people like Catherine. You'll hear from Jonathan. You people know a lot. You're the experts on the news of what's happening in terms of climate change. But the dot connecting, that there's a human health dimension, has gotten, I think, lost in a lot of the what goes into the public discourse. So my hat's off to all of you for bringing this up to the public for, because it's really, really important. So we've lived through now two summers, 2011 and 2012, of this record-breaking heat. There's heat, there's drought, there's wildfires, there's West Nile virus, other infectious diseases that Francesca mentioned. There's extreme rainfall events. But we know more and more, as people have said, including this morning Catherine, this is what climate change looks like. This is what our future will look like, and there's a health dimension to this unless we take action. So just to draw some of those climate and human health links, as temperatures increase, both temperatures every day and heat waves, we know that there's a tremendous burden on public health that's happening, that people unfortunately perish by the hundreds. We know that there have been historic heat waves from the 2003 heat wave that happened in Europe, when some of the tallies are that as many as 70,000 people died in that heat wave from heat-related causes. I did a study with my colleagues at NRDC and the California Department of Public Health of one heat wave in the state of California in 2006. There were more than 16,000 additional emergency department visits during that heat wave, and 1,200 additional people sent to the hospital. These are billions of dollars in health costs and human pain and suffering from the heat that we're seeing. And all the climate science and model projections that we know, and they're getting better and better and converging, say more frequent, more intense, longer lasting heat waves moving into the future. Then there's air pollution. I think we don't talk enough about the linkage between rising temperatures, ground level ozone smog, which is really harmful to the health of people. And there's 25 million of us now in the U.S. with asthma. Asthma prevalence is increasing in all age categories this year. As temperatures increase, ground level ozone smog increases. It's been called getting a sunburn on your lungs. We know in future, by the middle of the century, there's projected to be 68% more unhealthy ozone smog days. As temperature rises, ragweed pollen seasons, the time over which ragweed is producing its pollen, and if you see me blowing my nose, sorry, during the panel, but it's because I have a ragweed allergy, and right now is ragweed pollen season. The season is getting longer because of rising temperatures, rising carbon dioxide, the number one greenhouse gas form of carbon pollution, makes plants from trees to weeds, like ragweed to grasses, produce more pollen. There's a burden on our respiratory health that's coming into play, and we're seeing it right now. We don't have to wait 50 or 100 years or look to places like Bangladesh that's having these, you know, historic floods like last year. We know that there's a relationship between climate change fueling more extreme rainfall events in places like Bangladesh, but right here as well. And there's also a relationship between those extreme rainfall events and waterborne diseases. There's tens of millions of cases of waterborne illnesses every year here in the U.S., and we need better systems, real-time systems of tracking environmental change and public health outcomes so that we can really say these are the effects right now, one-to-one, of climate change here in the U.S. Okay, the good news, we can make this better. We can move towards healthier, more secure communities. What causes climate change? It's carbon pollution that traps the heat in the atmosphere that sets these change of environmental changes and thence public health events, outcomes in our communities, in our homes into effect. Let's move rapidly towards non-polluting, cleaner, healthier forms of energy and move towards more secure communities. And the second piece, and then I'll close and move on, let's prepare. Let's invest in preparedness. We did a study that came out last year. There's $14 to $40 billion, with a B, billion dollars worth of health-related costs from just six of these kinds of climate-related events happening right now in the U.S. That's just six. If we stitch together the whole fabric of the kind of climate change-related events happening already, the toll would be much more. We need to figure in that price tag of what climate change is costing us right now. And avoid it. Avoid those costs. Move towards healthier communities. And we have the means to do that. Let's invest in preparedness and make sure that our leaders make preparedness a priority, too. I think we can totally get there.
Glad you're optimistic. That's great. Okay, so I want to introduce you to Jonathan Sleeman. Please note that there's a little misspelling there on the sign, but Jonathan is director of the Wildlife Health Center at the U.S. Geological Survey, and he is going to speak to the fact that these new emerging diseases that we've been talking about, infectious diseases and others, that there's a really unprecedented number of them related, unprecedented percentage, something like 75 to 80%, connected to wildlife and animal causes and diseases. So please welcome Jonathan.
Well, thank you, Francesca. Is this microphone working? No. Maybe I'll just... Okay. Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate Francesca inviting me to participate on this panel. Just to give you a little bit of background, the National Wildlife Health Center is one of several science centers within the U.S. Geological Survey. We are the unbiased independent science agency for the Department of Interior, and our focus is specifically on research on wildlife diseases. We do a lot of surveillance for these diseases, as well as research to get a deeper understanding. And we focus a lot on diseases that have impacts on wildlife populations, but also focus on diseases that have human health or economic implications. So what I'd like to focus on the time that I have is this idea of emerging infectious diseases and the fact that climate change is one of many environmental drivers of these diseases. And in fact, it's a very complex picture, and it's complex for us to understand where these drivers are coming from and how these diseases are emerging. But as Francesca mentioned, there are an unprecedented number of emerging infectious diseases. Over the past several decades, we've seen a number of them. You've probably heard of them, SARS, Nipah virus, West Nile virus being introduced in North America. Probably some less known ones like white nose syndrome in bats. Of which the vast majority, as Francesca mentioned, 60-70%, have some sort of connection to wildlife. Now, the reason is there are a number of environmental or global changes that are taking place that are driving these emergences. For example, there's the increased contact between humans and wildlife, allowing spillover of pathogens into human populations and actually back from humans into wildlife. There's increased globalization, a movement of people and commodities are allowing pathogens to jump to new continents breaking down these geographic barriers. And then climate change is just one of the many factors that are driving these diseases. That plus the fact that these diseases are ever evolving, these pathogens are evolving and adapting to new environments and new hosts, is creating this perfect storm for disease emergence and resurgence. Now, these diseases are having global and profound impacts. They're causing economic losses. They're causing human deaths and human pandemics. They're causing loss of wildlife, extinctions, and population declines of wildlife, and they're resulting in ecological disturbances and disruption. And I think human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, is a classic case in point. It is now known that virus emerged from a similar virus in African primates, probably from the butchering and consumption of bushmeat in Africa, spilled into the human population. And now we have 35 million people globally living with HIV, which is a huge burden on the public health system. These diseases have impacts on food security. To control outbreaks of highly pathogenic H5N1 avian influenza in Southeast Asia, there's at least 200 million poultry have been culled, which has had an impact on food security in that region. And then certainly from our interest, we're seeing a lot of diseases that are driving wildlife population declines and extinctions. 6 million bats in North America are now estimated to have died from white nose syndrome, a disease that's probably introduced from Europe as a result of a human movement of the fungus into North America. Chytrid fungus in amphibians is also causing declines. Now, climate change is clearly one of those factors and a very important factor. It's having a number of complex complex issues related to human health. You've got the direct effects that was mentioned earlier, and I'm not going to touch upon them because I think others are probably more versed to talk about them. But I just want to let you know that in addition to seeing heat stroke and heat related deaths in people, we're also seeing heat stress in moose in Minnesota, and actually seeing declines in populations of moose as a consequence. And we're probably going to see moose having to move up further north. We are seeing diseases move into higher elevations. Avian malaria is a major threat to endangered Hawaiian birds on a number of the islands on the Hawaiian archipelago. These birds can only live at certain elevations because the mosquitoes which transmit the avian malaria can't live at higher elevations. Well, as temperature increases, these mosquitoes are moving up into these higher areas and further endangering very endangered birds. At the same time, we're seeing human malaria, also transmitted by mosquitoes, move up higher elevations in certain continents like Africa. We're seeing tick-borne diseases. The black-legged tick is now being found further north into Canada, southern Ontario, other parts of Canada. They're probably being brought in by birds that kind of drop the ticks. The temperatures are now conducive to allow these ticks to survive in these northern climes, and are starting to see Lyme disease and other zoonotic vector-borne diseases being transmitted in these areas where they previously haven't seen Lyme disease. So the question is, what can be done? Well, from my perspective, we know climate change is occurring. We know all the predictions of changes in weather patterns. Mid-continental summer droughts are going to increase, sea level rises, and so forth. And I'm no expert on the sort of causes of climate change, but if you look at the projections, we're going to continue to see a warming climate. Consequently, from my perspective, I would concur with the previous speakers that we need to move to preparedness. And one of the sort of interesting concepts has emerged the past few years, although certainly not new, is this idea of one health, that human health, wildlife health, and domestic animal health are all connected within the context of environmental ecosystem health. And that we need to combine all these what were previously stovepipe disciplines it together to address these issues of mutual concern, to look for optimal outcomes, not just for human health, but also for wildlife health and for the health of the environment. We've got some new analytical models and new laboratory techniques, molecular techniques that are providing us with the mathematical and molecular tools to address these diseases. We can get a lot smarter in a surveillance and early detection of these diseases. We need to ensure we have the capacity to respond robustly and quickly when these disease outbreaks do occur so we can control them as quickly as possible. We need to try and get better data, or at least use the data more smartly to try and derive. It's a huge challenge, but I think we need to start looking at sort of predictive models so we can get a better understanding of these environmental drivers, predict the potential of these outbreaks, and apply our resources to these geographic areas, the so-called hotspots of greatest concern. So I basically think this issue of emerging diseases, the issue of climate change, it's a shared responsibility. It's something that we're all going to have to address, and I think something we're really going to have to take very seriously because I think too much is at stake for us to fail. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jonathan. And next I want to, as you can tell, there's so much research going on and so much knowledge, and with that I'd like to introduce Catherine Hayhoe, who several of you listened to this morning, if you were up early enough, which I think many of you were. And Catherine is a climatologist at Texas Tech. She's also kind of a leader in the climate movement vis-a-vis the evangelical movement, if I may say so. And I wanted to just also mention that she is the author of a book, which came out in 2009. Called A Climate for Change, and it's looking at global warming facts for faith-based decisions. So she's reaching out to another audience that perhaps hasn't been open to climate change issues. So with that, I'd like to introduce Catherine. Thank you.
I should mention that I wrote the book with my husband, who is a pastor of a church here in Texas. And when we got married, he didn't actually think climate change was real. I didn't know that. He didn't know that I actually studied climate change. And we discovered that after we got married. I think this is off. Is this off? You're picking up? Okay. Can you guys hear me in the back row? Yes. Okay. Good. Climate change and health. There's a lot of research in that area. There's a lot of very interesting research with medical professionals getting together with climate scientists. My colleague and Jonathan's colleague, John Patz at University of Wisconsin-Madison, is one of the leaders in this field. If you look at the literature, if you look at the scientific literature, and even if you look at the journal, at the news articles and news coverage, the stories on climate change and health tend to focus in three main areas. The first area is heat-related mortality and morbidity. That's what we call it in the scientific journals. Heat deaths and heat illness is what you call it when you're writing about it. That's a little bit counterbalanced by a decrease in cold-related morbidity. That's pretty straightforward. We have a pretty good handle on that because we know when heat waves have occurred in the past. We can estimate mortality rates. We're pretty good at predicting future temperature. We're pretty sure about that. So that is one of the most solid areas of science, is the impact of climate change on heat-related mortality and morbidity. And kind of the defining event, I think, in that category was the European heat wave of 2003. It took them 4 years to do the final death count on that, but when they did it, it ended up being around 70,000 people in 1 3-week period. And that is what they call technically excess mortality, which means people who would not have died otherwise. So the second category is impacts on air pollution, which Kim discussed earlier. The fact that as temperatures rise, the chemical reactions that form that ozone happen quicker. And that has profound implications on respiratory health, and especially on anybody who has a child or has asthma themselves. The third area is the one that Jonathan just talked about, which is geographic shifts in infectious diseases, especially ones that are carried by insects or by animals that are temperature sensitive. As it gets warmer, certain species could move into new areas where they didn't used to be, and the assumption is that they would carry the disease with them. we had a new study just out this summer looking at the fact that it isn't just where the mosquitoes are. The virus, we looked at dengue specifically, dengue needs a certain amount of time to incubate. And so in some places you already have the mosquito, but it doesn't live long enough for the virus to incubate. Climate change would extend the life of the mosquito, allowing dengue to incubate. So I have this little handout at the back. It looks really boring on the front, but I promise you there are nice color pictures on the inside. Let's see. There we go. Here's a nice color picture. And so in this handout, I kind of summarized these three areas where most of the scientific research has occurred. And then what I did was I attached the section from a National Academy report from last year on health. The reason why I attached that is because it's the most recently published scientific summary on the topic of climate change and health. We have a new IPCC report coming out next year. We have a new national assessment coming out next year. Those will both cover health. But up to this point, what I just attached here is the most recent scientific summary that we have. But the point I want to make is not to focus on any one of these three areas. And I can say this without bias because I've actually published in each of these three areas. So even though I have done that, I think that focusing on these three points alone represents a very limited perspective on how climate change can affect our health. Climate change is going to affect our food supply. It is going to affect our water resources. It is going to lead to floods and to droughts, and it's going to impact our infrastructure. So the point I want to make is that the potential impacts of these things on human health far exceeds, I believe, the impacts of the three things that we most commonly talk about. Think of famines. Think of flooding like they had in Pakistan. Think of coastal flooding that could displace up to 300 million environmental refugees over the century. Think of that type of scale of human movement. What impact does that have on health? When you have a country that is very disrupted, one of the first things to go in that country is the public health infrastructure. So when you are talking about large-scale disruption of huge areas, we're talking about a complete breakdown in our ability to care for people. And then we're talking about things that nowadays, you know, it'd be easy to treat. It's like, oh, give them some antibiotics, they'll be fine. If there's no public health system operating, you can't even treat those types of things. So what I wanted to just kind of challenge you with today, you who tell stories, when you tell stories about climate and health, think beyond the three topics that we normally talk about. It's not that those aren't important, but the bigger story, I think, is that climate change has these global impacts that could affect our health in ways that we're not even imagining yet, but they could be devastating. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Catherine. I wanted to draw upon what Catherine was saying and point out a book that I recently came upon called Six Modern Plagues, which kind of enlarges the circle beyond even climate change and talks about other ways in which human beings have altered the landscape through land use, deforestation, assortment of other things, and speaks to some of the diseases that we've talked about. In terms of furthering this discussion, because I want, you know, to leave enough room for you all to raise your questions, and we have about 40 minutes to do that, 45 minutes. I wanted to talk, just raise the issue of the extent to which the public health side of climate change is sidelined, and whether any of you had observed this, and to ask the panelists to address this, because if you look at the different government agencies and what they've said about this challenge, in fact, they've said very strong things. The American Public Health Association declared climate change one of the most serious public health threats facing our nation. In a 2009 Lancet report said climate change could be the biggest global health threat of the 21st century. And yet, you know, for those of you who are at the session this morning, we saw an incredible videotape looking at all the, you know, kind of an aggregate of all the different climate change impacts from wildfires, coastal erosion, inundation, and so forth. And, you know, actually health was not in there. So I find that some, you know, maybe it's our own denialism, but we often don't think about climate change as actually, you know, affecting us. So I wanted to ask the panelists, whether they felt that the public health establishment was, you know, had a good enough handle on this, apart from their budgets and their ability to carry forth with this, but whether they had done a good enough job in reaching out, you know, to the public to communicate these dire threats. So if you would address that.
Sure. Well, we're trying, but we clearly haven't done a good enough job yet, because there is all this research, more and more, from what we've just brought to the fore to the National Climate Assessment for 2013 that you mentioned, Catherine. There's actually going to be a first draft of that out for public and agency comment in early December. So watch for that. That's going to be, you know, something that all of us can look at, and we'll be talking about the state of our understanding about what climate change is doing to health here in the U.S. And it's going to be about all kinds of sectors, not just health, but it'll be energy and water resources and land and everything. But to your question, I'm biased because I'm a health scientist, so I work in the communities of people that are, this is our bread and butter, and we're doing the research. I think it may be that we're not communicating well enough, strongly enough, in ways that are about everyone where we live and getting into people's lives and backyards and saying, here's the research and it's global, but here are the effects, and they're about you and your kids and your households and what happens to you day to day. And beyond, here's the effects. They're pretty alarming. Here's what we can do to, one, prepare, protect your health so, you know what to do on a day when the air quality is terrible or there is a heat wave, but look out beyond and do something about the bigger issue. We made some maps. I'm going to do a mini pitch for some maps that NRDC did. It's, the URL is nrdc.org/climatemaps, plural, because it tries to do just this. It lets people visit the maps, which are 6 different maps of the U.S., and there's drought, extreme heat, air pollution, infectious diseases, flooding, and extreme events from 2011. And it lets you type in your zip code or look at your state and zoom in and look at the health effects in your backyard. So people can start having the conversation about, what does it mean for my life? How can I protect myself? And how do we move to that sort of safer, healthier, more progressive future? So I think it's a communications piece. That's why you all are very important.
I thought we were going to show something in the projector, but if we're not, maybe we could turn it off.
There we go.
Yeah.
our carbon footprint.
Yeah. That thing's the biggest projector I've ever seen in my life. I just wanted to second what Kim said. I think that's absolutely right, that we're not bringing it down to the local scale at which people can function. The most successful climate change and health-related study that I did was for the city of Chicago, where we took the exact characteristics of the 1995 heat wave, where they knew exactly what the impacts of that were. They knew how many deaths there were. They knew how many additional hospital admittances there were. They knew the outbreaks of violence that there were in the south side of Chicago during the heat wave. They knew all of that because it had happened fairly recently. So we took that exact heat wave and we calculated how frequently that heat wave would occur in the future. And when we told them that for the city of Chicago, under lower emissions, if we can reduce our emissions globally 80% by 2050. So under that type of a scenario, we'd be looking at one 1995 heat wave every 3 or 4 years. And that was the worst heat wave they'd ever had. Under higher emissions, we would be looking at an average of 3 of those heat waves every year. That made a huge difference to their public health department because they knew the cost. And that was one of the things they cite in the actions they took to reduce their urban heat island effect. So that if climate change increases by this much, but they decrease their urban heat island effect, they could stay the same. And so they're actually doing that. They're putting green roofs on things and stuff like that. Because an urban health is a huge part of that. Yeah.
So I would just like to add that I think in addition to thinking about public health infrastructure in the United States, we also need to consider the public health infrastructure in developing countries. Because many of these emerging diseases that are threats to the United States have a foreign international origin. And the state of the public health infrastructure, and actually, if I put a plug, the veterinary infrastructure too, is in many countries non-existent or very poor. And this allows those diseases to emerge, get a foothold, and then can spread globally. So I think we need to broaden our thinking beyond what we need for the United States, but think also global capacity to address these disease issues. I think one other thing, maybe it relates to communication piece, but I think we need to do a better job at anticipating. You know, everyone wants like the predictive model, and that's the sort of holy grail. Can we predict when these diseases are going to emerge? But I think we can anticipate when there's going to be issues. For example, this summer, as you know, there was a major drought and heat wave in the Midwest, and it's speculative whether it's related to the West Nile virus. But at the same time, there's deer hunters out there probably heard of hemorrhagic disease in deer. Mm-hmm. We saw epidemic proportions of hemorrhagic disease in deer, and there's been good science to show it's linked to mild winters, dry summers, and high heat summers. And so we could actually anticipate, get messages out to hunters, be able to provide that communication piece ahead of time. And I wonder whether we need to start thinking about, even that may not come true, to provide some messaging to help people protect themselves.
I wanted to ask the panelists if they have been working on adaptation strategies with any. I know you have with Catherine with Chicago, haven't you? Whether you've been working on any adaptation strategies that localities can be involved in.
I can't take the credit for working on any of them, but I know they are. Mm-hmm. We are as humans very adaptable, and so with a lot of these things we see here, especially with the heat-related issues, we can adapt by modifying our behavior and our infrastructure, and even just by warning people, like literally saying, don't work in the garden today, or check on your neighbor today, or here's a cooling center that you can go to. So there is a lot that we can adapt to at the smaller scale, but getting back to the larger global framework, that stuff is hard to adapt to. That stuff, like what you mentioned, developing nations' infrastructure and public health systems, that is beyond just the kind of little let's feel good and plant a green roof thing. So it's tough. What'd you say?
Yeah. We're working with, locally, it is so much of it, the work is local. At NRDC, I'm in the New York office of NRDC, and we're working with the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, because they have in the city one of the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, grants to beef up the city's adaptation planning. And there's a work group that's about health adaptation, so we're one of the people that sits in and listens to their plans, and they're doing fantastic work that's really focused on health. We are working with a group of partners in India, in Ahmedabad, India, in Gujarat, which is a western state in India, on a heat vulnerability reduction plan. I mean, there's a lot of health challenges, as you said, Jonathan, in a place like India, from waterborne illnesses and infectious diseases, but heat is a terrific problem there. It gets really hot, and there's a lot of strategies that can be taken to reduce that. So we do have a partnership going on there. And we're looking sort of nationally at the states that do and don't have health elements in their adaptation plans. There's only like a third of the U.S. states that have anything about health in their state adaptation plan, which we need to do better than that. So we're trying to survey sort of where vulnerability and exposure kind of meets preparedness. So we're kind of excited about that.
I also wanted to tell you that I came across this publication, Center for Climate and Energy Solutions, looking at extreme weather and climate change, understanding the link and managing the risk. And there are dozens of examples around, particularly in the developing world, that are so phenomenally more huge. Pakistan, the temperature rising to 123 degrees in recent years, and, you know, thousands of people dying. And, of course, they are going to be having some of these terrific health impacts before we do, but it's hitting our shores as well. But I want to leave enough time for everyone to have a chance to ask questions of our illustrious panel here. So, Tom?
I have theories.
Let's see. I'll be brave. Let me just state this is just my guess, and other, I think probably there's people here who have even better guesses than I do. I think that the answer is probably different depending on what side of the fence you're on. It seems over the last few years that denial of the science of climate change has become a tenet of the Republican Party. If you look at many people 5 years ago in the Republican Party, they were saying things very different than they're saying today. So there has been a major shift in that perspective to the point where it's almost like an article of belief. If you say climate change is real, you cannot be a Republican. Now, talk to the folks at Conserve America, and they would disagree with you on that, but I think most people feel that way. The other side of the fence, I don't know, it's very difficult to guess, but if I guess, I would say that that's not the hill they want to die on right now. But if you look at the polls, I mean, you guys have probably been looking at the polls, right? Apparently, most of independent voters and Democratic voters are interested in climate change and would like their candidate to say something about it. So I'm kind of surprised. Are they not looking at the polls? And so the question of why that's happened over the last 5 years is a tricky question. And there's a PBS documentary that's going to air on the 23rd, which is next week, which on Frontline, so it's, I think it's like 10 Eastern on the 23rd, and that's the exact question they ask, is why over the last 5 years have things changed? So hopefully I'll find out the answer by watching that. I'm not aware of any. The only situation I'm aware of is the Alaskan town of Kivalina that's suing to recoup their moving costs. No. And I would be surprised if you hear about a lot, because there's actually verses in the Bible that seem to suggest quite clearly that suing people is not the way to go. So you're going to have to find, so I think as a denomination, that's not going to be something you see a lot in the future. Yeah.
I do. It's such a great question. And of course, I can't explain. I absolutely can't explain why climate change hasn't been part of the debate, talk yet, because it's such an important topic. And we can only hope that it will be a part of the last, discussion, because it's a challenge, but there's enormous opportunity in every challenge. And this is a real opportunity for the candidates to talk about something that presents such a great chance for the country to do something really progressive for energy, for health, and economy too. I'll tell you one thing that strikes me, that the health costs of whatever energy sources we are using haven't come into the discussion at all. And I mentioned this before, that we had looked at just six of these climate change related events that had happened in the last decade between 2002 and 2009, and there were billions, between $14 and $40 billion of health-related costs that need to get figured into any discussion that we're having about the way that we get energy, what climate change means. So I think that the president and the candidate and any political figure really needs to put our health into the front and center of the picture, because it really is just a big plus opportunity to make preparedness pay. It's going to pay off for us. But when it's not in the picture, it's such a losing proposition. And I agree with you. It's like, where is this topic? Mm-hmm. That's right. Right. So maybe we need to lead. Look, so it was today or yesterday, just this week, that the George Washington University and Yale did another one of their polls on the American public sort of response to climate change. And now 46% of Americans feel personally affected by climate change. Wait, I have it. More Americans now see climate change as a direct threat to their families than ever before. 46%. That, I think, really hinges on the experiences that people have endured in 2012 and 2011. So the populace is connecting to this issue. Cities are preparing. A third of the states are preparing. I mean, businesses, many of them are progressive on this. Maybe we need to lead our leaders on this more and more. And there have been, there is progressive movement at the highest level, but maybe we just need to do more. Oh, I don't know. I always turn it and put it on my shoulders. It's like, what can I do to communicate more strongly and to take more action and be with people and figure out how to link arms more with people to do something positive? Because I can't speak to the sort of strategies there. I just don't know. Sure. Shall I take a stab? Okay. Well, more and more schools of public health and medical schools are putting climate change and health teaching and training into their curricula. So that's one piece. I mean, the conversation that we're having is going forth into the professional places that it needs to be. And then the scholarship is being taken to the professionals that are going to be seeing patients that are going to be coming into, you know, exam rooms with, you know, respiratory or heat-related or waterborne, other, you know, conditions that really need to be evaluated and discussions that can be had. So there's that. The public health community is quite engaged on this set of issues. The American Public Health Association is having its annual meeting from the 29th to 31st. It's coming right up. There's more than 120 sessions or talks on climate change and health, some aspect of. And that's a lot. That's just taking off. The American Public Health Association, their annual meeting is in San Francisco, but they've been very responsive to the community's interest over the last decade, but even in the last 5 or 6 years. The number of presentations, which is reflective of the research and the interest and the student interest, like the coming generation, I think sees this as a topic that affects them very directly. And Jonathan, as you said, these are international students too. It's not just here in the States. This is, you know, people from all around the world.
Oh, can I just mention too, though, I think with the bigger issues, it's not just the public health sector, it's international relief and development, and even national and international security. You have to be concerned about these type of issues, and they are. But I think that we have to think a little bit, again, beyond the public health sector, too, if we think about the whole big perspective on this.
If I can add just briefly, and this may seem a minor component compared to what was discussed before, but I recently saw a presentation. I think that the gentleman's name was Arnie Bernstein from Harvard University. He's a pediatrician, and he gave this very nice presentation, and it was all about the importance of environmental integrity and biodiversity to human health. And I think the power of his message was the fact that he was a physician, a pediatrician, that was talking about these things. And so I think the more the physicians can embrace some of these environmental issues and the biodiversity issues, climate change issues, I think that they can lend the weight of their profession behind all these topics. So there are several efforts that I'm aware of, both here in the United States as well as globally, to try and in a sense, as an inventory of what pathogens are out there, what pathogens do we know about, what pathogens that are in wildlife reservoirs that are unknown but that could potentially be pathogens, what are the potential vectors, and what potential species are out there. I think there's the Tree of Life inventory now also taking place. I think these are all very, very good efforts to help us understand what is out there, what are the potential risks, and how they could potentially be introduced into North America, and by what routes. And do we have the competent vectors here in the United States to transmit those diseases? Do we have susceptible hosts? All those pieces of information can be put together to really help us understand what are the major disease risks. Now, Rift Valley fever in particular is one of interest because we do know that we have competent reservoirs for this disease and competent vectors in the United States. And there's a lot of trade of animal products between Africa, where it's mostly taking place, and the United States, as well as the Caribbean. So that is a particular interest. And it's a devastating disease of livestock mostly, but also can spill over into humans. So that is definitely a disease. And so I think all these efforts that are being done to try and understand what are the potential next major epidemics or pandemics. I guess one thing I just would like to add, though, is one of the things I've noticed, and this is purely anecdotal, is that very often these diseases are diseases that come out of us, to use a baseball analogy, left field. Who'd imagine that a fungus from Europe would be introduced into a cave in New York and kill off 6 million bats? I mean, so part of this, I think, is always going to be a little unpredictable.
I want to just add to speak to what Tom was raising as, you know, why is this not more on the radar? And there was a study showing that among undecided voters, that climate change could very well be an issue that swung the election. And I think this was a Yale study, but I could find the source for you. And then Lisa's question about health and, you know, relating it to the public health community. There was a study recently, and I think you know about it, Catherine, where they found that the public health frame was something that seemed to cut across partisan issues, and that they found these pollsters, when they started asking people about how they related to climate change, that when they asked them about health, the health impacts of it, that there was more, there was more resonance to it. And NPR had a story on it about a month ago, so if anybody's interested in that, I can, you know, turn you on to that as well.
We have a study that we're just finishing up right now on exactly that topic. Jessica Hellman at University of Notre Dame is leading that. She's an ecologist who specializes in mosquitoes. And Jessica was just making that point to me the other day. We're talking about Dallas. And I was saying, you know, Jessica, I was just watching the news, and that was all I saw every night was spraying. And she's just like, I cannot believe that that's what they're doing. It's like trying to kill a fly with like a 2-ton sledgehammer. She said, she's actually looked at mosquito abatement programs. They are, the budget for mosquito abatement for a big city like Dallas is like this big. So if they just had a regular mosquito abatement program, it costs them almost nothing, and it would be quite safe. Whereas all of that spraying has all kinds of unintended side effects because it sprays everything. So there's a real possibility there. There's a real potential for cities to just put into place a tiny little cost-effective mosquito abatement program. But no, we are knee-jerk people. We react when we see the threat, not when we don't. And I think that's where psychology comes into it. We would rather kill the fly with a sledgehammer than spend a tiny, tiny little bit just making sure the fly never landed. So, go ahead.
No, I agree completely. I think that's what I was trying to mention earlier is we need to anticipate these issues and then do some basic interventions before they become major events. And even if they don't, I think you're going to costs. The cost is going to be far less than having to respond, as you said, you know, reactively to these outbreaks.
But invest and have the investment be ongoing. Have the mosquito control program that's like this, as opposed to the sledgehammer, as you say. But it's happening in an ongoing way, so the investment is sustained. There's been some estimate that for every dollar invested in preparedness, in a preparedness plan or some element like that, you save $4 in response costs after the fact. So that's a pretty good margin of savings.
Well, you should check West Nile virus when it hit New York City, and I think it was 1999. And they faced huge public opposition because of the fear of the pesticides. But since then, I think they've really set up this program, you know, to get rid of the puddles and all the other, causes that, you know, bring in the mosquitoes. So.
Sorry, if I just have one other thing is we're actually doing some research right now that indicates that the pesticides they're used to spraying actually have an immunosuppressive effect on a lot of avian species, which may actually enhance the replication and transmission of some of these viruses. So again, there's a lot of unintended consequences of the sledgehammer.
That's always the problem, is putting dollars on stuff. That is the problem, because a lot of us, as scientists, we don't have access to the dollar information. So the reason why it was so effective with Chicago is because we were talking to somebody who had the dollar info on that heat wave. Whereas at the federal level, they don't have the dollar info on heat-related mortality or morbidity. But I would like to ask Kim to speak to that, because I think the national assessment chapter on health will have everything but the dollars, I think. I hope. What do you think?
Well, I can't talk about the findings yet, but there will be an appreciation of how important figuring out costs are. And there's a lot more people now working on just this, trying to figure out the cost dimension of what climate change means in the health sector, in the ecology, ecosystem sector, in the energy, water, all the sectors. There's going to be 30 chapters in the National Climate Assessment. It's going to cover all kinds of topics. But you're right, trying to put the data together and working with the economists to come up with one methodology is its own challenge. But there's a lot of interest, and people are starting to do this now, because it does seem like the economic argument coupled with the other substantive arguments are where we're at now. But we can't forget what's behind the dollars. It's, you know, the loss of a species, an ecosystem. It's human pain and suffering. It's, you know, mortality. It's illness. It's that too. And it's dollars. So we have to keep casting it both ways.
Yeah.
Oh, and there's copies of a fact sheet that's based on that cost study in the back of the room, if anyone's interested.
On that note, I put out a bunch of materials from the Centers for Disease Control. Well, they wanted to come. They weren't able to because of budget considerations right now. But there's a whole array of fact sheets from CDC back there. And I can leave you all with my email address, and I can circulate a number of links that the National Institute for Health gave me. The NIEHS has a whole bunch of materials on this, and they've got a lot of initiatives going in this regard. You'd be surprised how much is going on. So I can just share my email address, or we can circulate a page with it. You can give me your email addresses. So, yeah, you have a question?
I'd say, well, first of all, a lot of these countries, developing nations, they have huge public health challenges. And looking out for the next emerging disease may not necessarily be the top priority. So understandably, a lot of their investments, what they do have, tend to go on major issues, you know, malaria control, other things, and the endemic diseases that already exist, reducing child mortality and that type of thing. USAID has funded a number of projects that are now taking place globally called PREDICT and RESPOND, and they've started to go out there and sample wildlife and collect viruses and other pathogens or potential pathogens and start that inventory. And actually, it proved quite useful because, this new coronavirus that emerged in the Middle East, they're able to take all the coronaviruses they found and compare it and actually help to kind of establish maybe where this coronavirus had come from. So I think we're starting to do a lot of that effort, but it's expensive, it's time-consuming. It may not necessarily be a priority for these developing nations. So I think it's always going to be something we're going to have to invest in to do and make sure it links in with the priorities for local countries too.
Take my prerogative as a moderator to ask another question, which is if you could suggest a single story that any of the reporters out here would want to do in this vein that would really make a difference, what would it be?
Or one or two.
Boy. Well, that's hard, of course. One thing that occurs to me is having been at a hearing about the proposed carbon regulation by the EPA to limit carbon pollution from new industrial sources, and going to a hearing and hearing citizens, people with asthma, talk about what a day of extreme heat and ozone means to them and how it compromises the quality of their life day to day, how they can't go to school, can't go to work, how an employer can't employ the 20 people who rely on her, and the immediacy of some of these stories about people whose lives right now, here and now, in cities across the country are being affected by the conditions, the extreme, essentially weather conditions that are what climate change looks like. To me, that was one of the most arresting events for me of this past year, was interacting with a person and talking to her and talking to the gentleman who couldn't go outside and be with his friends on these high ozone and high heat days, because Philadelphia just suffered this year. But that's happening in cities all across the country. So to me, that's probably the most arresting human story. My other favorite story is that we need a real-time tracking system in this country to watch what's happening in the way of heat and air pollution and flood injury, all of these events that happen related to climate change. We don't have a real-time tracking system to answer the question, how many people died of the extreme heat this summer? How many heat-related illness cases were there this past summer? Because we are not yet connecting to a centralized real-time monitoring system. We're almost there. We could be there. Right now, it's only Missouri that does that. We need to do that. So as researchers and as a community of people concerned about this, we can begin to connect those dots.
That's a really hard question. I think I would just offer more of a general suggestion. We talked earlier this morning, and we talked yesterday too, about the issue that whenever an event happens, you go to a climate scientist, you say, was this climate change? The climate scientist says the same old thing. We cannot attribute any one event, but this is consistent with, and so on and so forth. I think that a different question to ask is, would this event recur in the future because of climate change, and if so, how much? And if so, then we can very precisely measure the health impact of that type of event. So whenever any event happens that has an impact on people's health and welfare, which most extreme weather events do, maybe the question to ask the scientist or whatever source you're talking to is not, did climate change cause this event, but how frequently will climate change cause this event to recur in the future? Because we know what happened now, what would happen if we had one of those every year?
I guess if I'm allowed to, I guess the first thing is what I mentioned in my opening remarks about this concept of One Health. It's something that's been discussed fairly widely in the scientific community, at least in the medical and the veterinary community. Even government agencies like the CDC has a One Health office, the USDA has a One Health office, the Department of Interior has a One Health working group. You know, and so it's being talked about in government circles. And I think it's a useful, at least a theoretical concept to help people link between their health and the health of wildlife and the health of the environment. And somehow to me that connection isn't always made. They don't see a direct effect of all these environmental changes, landscape changes, and climate change directly on their livelihoods, on their health. And so I think some sort of getting at least this theoretical concept out there, I think what Mon talked about, and people to start to see the linkages, to me is an important story. I think I'll just stick with the one.
Well, if I stole one of yours, I would be about the whole, you know, diseases coming from wildlife, so we should look.
Yeah.
I thought that was good.
It could be. I think that more and more cities are really are starting to see climate change as being part of what needs to be built in to all aspects, excuse me, of planning. I was just reading that Louisville, Kentucky, the mayor came forward with a really comprehensive plan to address climate change and said, to do otherwise would be irresponsible. This is an issue that's affecting us. Oh, look. Perfect, perfect. And it's comprehensive. It's like dealing with the combined sewer overflows and dealing with the public health infrastructure and dealing with transportation and urban heat islands. And it's a really, you know, it's a broad view into the future. And I think that that's just one example. There's, you know, any number, dozens and dozens of other cities that are building this kind of appreciation, because ultimately it saves dollars in the longer term or even the shorter term. We're not talking about, you know, savings decades down the road, much, much nearer term than that.
I was going to also say King County, Washington State is doing a lot, you know, that's very proactive, which is kind of counterintuitive. You wouldn't think in the rainy Northwest that they would be so much on top of thing, you know, heat waves and so forth, but they're a good place to look as well. And this, a friend of mine, Mark Hertzgard, wrote a book called Hot, and I think he has a chapter that links to King County. Does anybody have any other questions? I'm under, oh, there we go. Since I didn't start, definitely. I am so happy that Jonathan came, U.S. Geological Survey, and they have all these amazing maps that show where the diseases are going in animals and humans, and they've got it all together. I wanted to share my email address with you in case you would like to correspond with me. I can share the links that I was sent by the various government agencies that couldn't be here, EPA, CDC, NIH, and they sent me a whole raft of things that are really very interesting, and I'm sure there'll be local angles that you can pick up on. So it's I'm Francesca Lyman, and it's Chicha19, C-H-I-C-H-A-1-9, at comcast.net. Or I can give you my card if you come up. Well, thank you guys so much for attending this panel, which I was so, you know, had so many interesting elements to it and perspectives and aspects that, you know, one wouldn't even expect. And I'm so thankful to the panelists for all coming from various parts of the country. I'm thankful to you. And please help yourself to all the materials back there. And I'm under orders to... I'm under orders to tell you to go to the SCJ membership meeting at 3:30 in about...